I'm Afshin Ratansi, and you're watching Going Underground for the final show in this studio in 19 years to the eve of an invasion of Iraq by the US, UK, Australia and Poland that would arguably catalyse the killing, wounding or displacing of tens of millions all around the world. It was, of course, George W. Bush's Secretary of State Colin Powell who held a vial at the UN Security Council to make the flawed case for war in Iraq. And as the world today teeters on the edge of a global conflict that could be even more deadly than Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya or Syria. I'm joined now from Falls Church in Virginia by Powell's former Chief of Staff, Colonel Larry Wilkerson. Retired Colonel Wilkerson, thank you so much for coming back on the show. Just in the past few days, I think one reporter said to Jen Psaki, the press secretary for the White House, why are you sending in shotguns, pistols, grenade launchers and the like to the Ukrainian people as defensive weapons? What do you make of the massive amounts of arms on top of the ones given before Russia's invasion? What do you make of this arming of Ukraine?
Well, first of all, it's a domestic political requirement of President Biden, and he has to be very outspoken about it because he said he's not going to establish a no-fly zone or do anything that would provoke a wider war and possibly a war with Russia. So he's got to, on the other hand, show that he's doing everything he possibly can to his electorate because they want him to do more. So that's part of it. And another part of it is his military advice is probably these are the kinds of weapons, simple to use, easy to use. Anyone can learn in an hour how to use it that you ought to be providing because anything more sophisticated for the general population is probably not going to be workable. Those are the two primary reasons that they've made that sort of decision.
Do you think internally, at the Pentagon, let alone William Burns at the CIA, they think this war is in any way winnable against Russia?
No. And I think I was at a conference, first conference in 2 years, where people met in a room together yesterday. It was surreal. Russian experts, nuclear weapons experts, and so forth. And we all agreed that the only solution to this conflict is a diplomatic solution. A negotiation that lets Vladimir Putin at least gain some of what he wishes and allows much of Ukraine to remain a state, part of it being autonomous, perhaps, with referenda to be conducted. However you work out the details, a recognition that Crimea is going to be part of Russia forever and a day, some other things like that that would be appeasing to Moscow, and yet leave some kind of intactness to what Ukraine wants to be in its majority and settle with that and quit, because this is insanity. It is utter insanity. It is making a pariah of Putin. Rumors out of Beijing or even that Xi Jinping, his, quote, best friend, unquote, is thinking about making some kind of powerful statement condemning the invasion. It would be in China's interest to do so because the closer it stays with Putin, as long as he is doing this, the more it becomes a pariah too. And China already has a problem. And it has billions of dollars invested in its Base Road Initiative in Ukraine, which it was looking to be a fountain of product going into the wider Europe, particularly Western Europe. So Xi Jinping's got some hard decisions to make in the next week or two.
Yeah, but come on, what do you think he'll come out with?
I think China might fool you with regard to what it truly believes about violating sovereign borders. It's always had that policy. I met with the Chinese leaders, including Wang Yi, who's now their foreign minister plenipotentiary, a prospective Politburo member, in the summer of 2001, and talked with him at great length in policy planning talks with Richard Haass and Shui Ten Kai, later to be ambassador to the United States. So I know the Chinese pretty well, and I know they're having some deliberations right now about how they should act on this.
Well, there's nothing to suggest any separation from what previously they've said, not even an alliance, closer than an alliance between Beijing and Moscow. You know that I think you were saying in December something like this might happen. We've had Obama said the expansion of NATO would lead to a kind of confrontation that we're seeing. Kissinger did. You name it. I understand that George Kennan, the JFK diplomat, told Colin Powell about eastward expansion of NATO and the dangers of it when you were his chief of staff?
Absolutely. Kennan was 98 or 99 years old at the time, and he actually said it was the biggest strategic mistake America had made in the post-Cold War era, and might be the biggest one that we made in the so-called Cold War panorama. And I agreed with him. It made no sense whatsoever. It was done principally for arms merchants and arms sales and money to be made. And it's a preposterous proposition that Article 5, which is what makes NATO unique, an attack on one is an attack on all, has now been spread to countries that a person in West Texas, for example, doesn't even know where they are on a map. Montenegro, you asked a person from West Texas, are you willing to risk nuclear war for Montenegro? The first thing that rancher is going to ask you is, where is Montenegro?
So if these kinds of situations keep cropping up, the biggest partner, the biggest power demanding the 2% of GDP that could go on social programs in Europe, the biggest power, the USA, its membership of NATO would be in question?
I think you're looking at an alliance that's looking for a purpose, and it's been looking for a purpose ever since the Cold War ended. That purpose, as articulated by Colin Powell and George H.W. Bush and Edvard Shevardnadze and Mikhail Gorbachev, in a certain way, was eventual welcoming of Russia, not only geographically, because geographically it's there, into Europe, and even into NATO membership, first with a political alliance and then the military alliance. That went astray in 1994 and later years when we started doing this wild, abandoned expansion of the alliance. But that in no way condones an invasion into essentially a neutral country, which NATO leadership and Washington's leadership had already admitted they were willing to say would never be a member of NATO, much the way they have done pro forma with Georgia.
It's good you said that, because, of course, as you know, Washington, the Biden administration, let alone NATO leaders, yet Jens Stoltenberg and the rest say NATO expansion has nothing to do with the current conflict. And anyone who says that is a Putin apologist.
Well, I'm not a Putin apologist in any way. I think he's brutal. I think he's insane now. I thought he was pragmatic. I thought he was a brilliant strategist. I thought he was doing things capitalizing on U.S. strategic errors. I still think that, but now I think he's insane. And this is a brutal, look at what we've got going on right now. We got 75,000 children every day joining the refugee flow. We got probably 1,000 to 2,000 dead people. And a lot of those, and maybe even more than that, if we count them, are Russian soldiers, conscripts, who don't even know why they're there. I know a little bit about the Russian military. I know how we tried to counsel the Russian military leadership about having a professional force, volunteer force, and so forth. But I know how they still depend on conscripts. And frankly, Putin's disdain for these conscripts is alarming to a military professional like me.
So you believe the so-called mainstream media reports that it's not going well for Russia?
I don't believe the mainstream media at all. The mainstream media sucks.
But what you're saying there certainly departs from what the Russians are being told by their media, that the war
Absolutely.
Is going well, that it's a pincer movement, and that this is all about stopping the expansion of NATO. And if you heard what Vladimir Putin was saying the other day, this is a time of reckoning now, of a new world order, where Beijing, Moscow, Mumbai, Delhi, let alone the entire global south, it's the end of U.S. hegemony. This is the beginning of the end.
If this is a new world order, the new world order will not include Russia. That's the problem. And I'm getting my information from sources that have been giving me information on Russian maneuvers, for example, in Russia from 2012 on. I'm getting them from Scandinavians and others who've been actual observers at these exercises and who know the Russian military far better than anyone else, certainly I. And they've been telling me what's happening within the ranks of the Russian military. And they've been telling me about the disdain that Putin has for the military. He comes from the KGB. Why wouldn't he have? Our CIA disdains our military, too. There's no reason for me to believe that, bureaucratically speaking, in Russia, the KGB disdains the military also. So that's alarming to me as a military professional. But bigger here is the prospect of snatching opportunity from what is disaster right now. And that opportunity is to reshape the security architecture in Europe. And what I mean by that, three fundamentals. And your man, your journalist, as it were, Fyodor Lubinov, suggested this the other day. We need a new Paris Accord, and then we need a movement towards this architecture. There'd be three fundamentals to it. One, Washington gives up a desire to have hegemony over Western Europe. Two, Moscow gives up a desire to reconstruct the Soviet Union's hegemony over Eastern Europe. And three, Europe, 740 million strong with a GDP of equivalent to America's now, gets its political, financial, economic act together and stands up and forms its own security architecture. And that Europe would have Russia in it the way we have envisioned it in the early 90s. Russia is a part of Europe. Russia would be in that new security architecture. To hell with the CSTO. To hell with NATO. Europe, stand up and have Russia as a partner within your ranks.
Well, obviously, that is not what the Biden administration is seeking. Russia has said it doesn't want to recreate the Soviet Union. China, as we remember from that Alaska meeting when the Biden administration came in, said never lecture to China what it's doing. And in fact, there were Taiwan maneuvers this week against mainland China. China increasingly talking about U.S. The tragedy of U.S. hegemony. India refusing to support the UN Security Council resolution that the USA and Albania put at the UN. African countries, there are people demonstrating in the streets for Russia. Saudi Arabia not taking the call of Joe Biden as he begged for oil.
You've been listening to your own propaganda.
No, I'm just asking, how do you see this context? I mean, do they even recognize Maduro in Venezuela, the largest known oil reserves on Earth? Do they recognize Maduro suddenly?
No one, including my Russian contacts, by the way, no one tells me that they have a positive view of what's happening in Ukraine right now. From the Levant to South America to Central America, no one tells me. From Colombia, from Venezuela, from Algeria, from Egypt, no one tells me they have a positive view of it. Modi's problems in India right now are rampaging with his persecution of his Muslim population, which is the largest Muslim population in the world in a single state.
After Indonesia, I think.
Well, no, it's actually bigger than Indonesia's total population. Modi's got his own problems and has to walk a very tight line. Plus, he's buying all of his military equipment, or at least 60-70% of it, from Russia. So I understand that. But what we've got going on here, as I said, is an opportunity. Well, why would we want to take this opportunity? Because we have two huge threats in the world right now that are absolutely out of control. Nuclear weapons, largely because of the United States abandoning the ABM treaty to start it all off, and then the INF treaty, and then open skies. We've abandoned all of our arms control, and we both, Russia and us, the two predominant nuclear powers, are in fact embarked on a new nuclear arms race, and they're talking about battlefield utility. Russia's actually published military doctrine saying that if NATO were to penetrate CSTO area, they would hit the point and the flanks of the penetration with small yield tactical nuclear weapons. A very dangerous situation. Then the second crisis we need to meet, and we need to cooperate and collaborate, is the climate crisis. Look at the IPCC report of 28 February. We're headed towards 3 or 4 degrees. We're going to make this Earth unlivable.
Retired Colonel, I'll stop you there. More from the former U.S. Secretary of State, Colin Powell's Chief of Staff, after this break. Welcome back. I'm still here with retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, the former U.S. Secretary of State, Colin Powell's Chief of Staff. The climate crisis obviously is the worst challenge that the world faces, but there has been a lot of talk about nuclear weapons in recent weeks. Zelensky saying that maybe Ukraine were tricked into removing theirs. Has Russia now put an end to any ideas that NATO might have of putting in nuclear-capable missile launchers in Ukraine forever?
I would like to hope so. And let me just say that that's preposterous, because the codes and the authority for firing Ukraine's weapons never left Moscow. We know that. Colin Powell knew that. We knew that. So Ukraine giving up its nuclear weapons was just a pro forma event. How would they have used them?
You mean Putin would like the new? Putin would like those old nuclear weapons there. It would be good for Russia. Yeah.
But Moscow has the same kind of controls that we have. And you can't just go out and use a nuclear weapon because it's on your territory.
You're not going to say that our independent nuclear deterrent in Britain is dependent on the U.S. now, are you?
No, they've got the same policy as Moscow and Washington. They have their own codes and their own permissive action locks and other things that protect the nuclear stockpile. So saying that Ukraine should have kept its weapons would be like, I'm sitting on a piece of metal. I can't use it.
Wait, we invite President Zelensky on the show, of course. Jake Sullivan, the new national, relatively new national security advisor, though strongly associated with Libya, used the phrase full force against Russia. If one projectile hits over a border of a NATO nation, what do you think he means by full force?
Well, I think what we're looking at is people who are, shall we say, not schooled, as I just indicated, in the realities of the Cold War. You don't make those kinds of statements when you're facing nuclear power weapons, in other words, nuclear weapon powers. You have to walk a very fine line. We're not in this age when, you know, people talked about Hitler and stopping him because you don't want to appease him. You don't want to be a Chamberlain and so forth. That's bull. It's not analogous. We have nuclear powers now facing one another. And 45 million, 44 million Ukrainians committing suicide would be better than a general nuclear weapon exchange because 7 billion people would commit suicide. So this is not the kind of statement you want to make in this environment. These people have lost, both in Russia and in Moscow and in Washington, they've lost the lessons learned during the Cold War, which is you never want to start this because it will end with total destruction.
Well, we've had two former national security advisors on. We'd obviously love Jake Sullivan to come on. As for the, as you said, people in West Texas, but it could be right through the middle of the United States, which has seen such deindustrialization in recent decades. Do you think they're okay with all the weaponry being paid for with U.S. public money to Ukraine?
Yes, absolutely, because they have been horrified by what they're seeing with regard to Ukraine. And one thing the mainstream media has done all across the globe has been to portray what's happening there in pictorial form in many instances. Landsats are taking photographs and so forth. And the carnage on both sides, Russian tanks destroyed, for example, and cities and towns being artilleried and bombed, and it's going out into America.
But do they believe the same pictures again when they were being told that the Afghanistan war was okay, that the Libya war was okay, these things were successes for the United States? Or is the American public, as it faces direct impacts on their living standards, let alone the price of gas, petroleum, are they going to continue to believe the pictures the way the companies that produce their news arguably want to use them?
Well, that's a good question. Americans are particularly fickle sometimes about their support for things like humanitarian assistance for Ukraine. But right now, it's outpouring. I see signs in Starbucks, would you like to give money for Ukrainian refugees? And I see people forking out the dough. So right now, it's very much in favor of helping Ukraine. What happens in the future is anybody's guess. I'm sure some of that will dissipate. But I can tell you right now that the general feeling I'm getting from capitals all over the world is that they're surprised because they, like me, thought Putin to be a rather pragmatic man. And they see him now as being megalomaniacal and wanting a statue on Red Square 500 years from now that says, Vladimir Putin, greater than Catherine and Peter combined.
That's certainly the way the story is told by so-called mainstream media. I mean, why do you think...
No, I heard that from a Russian journalist, not from mainstream media.
Why do you... plenty of Russians oppose the war within Russia. We saw thousands arrested on the streets of major cities throughout Russia. Do you think when the Iraq war was going on, you were chief of staff to the Secretary of State, you would consider censoring media like the way the media is being censored in the United States and NATO countries today, RT, being taken down right across Europe, the use of Twitter and social media companies to destroy the other side and to curb any kind of dissent?
Let me tell you my view. Yesterday, I was asked to comment on an op-ed to go into one of our major newspapers done by military veterans. I said, I will approve and allow my signature to go on that op-ed if you change the last paragraph. The last paragraph had a sentence in it that said something like this before I changed it. It said, Putin should be hauled before the International Criminal Court or wherever, and he should be prosecuted to the maximum extent of the law as being a war criminal. I said, you have to change that sentence to read, as it reads, comma, as should George W. Bush and Dick Cheney for establishing a torture regime and state approval.
Well, as you know, they say they, well, they're not, as does Tony Blair, although you left that name out.
Well, too much words.
Of that. Actually, come to think of it, talking about the International Criminal Court, it was Ukraine that brought to the World Court, International Court of Justice, saying, look, Russia's claims there was genocide against ethnically Russian people in the east of Ukraine was genocide. And the court said, look, we can't say whether the Russian claims are true or not. If they were, then under Article 51, there was a possibility that Russia's invasion of Ukraine is actually allowed under international law. But at the same time, Russia must suspend its activities in Ukraine. Is there a way out in the World Court because of genocide claims by Moscow? And the Duma, of course, the Communist Party of Russia, very much to the fore, forcing the hand, some say, in Russia, of the United Russia Party that supports Putin in Moscow.
Well, I think those kind of efforts are preposterous, actually. I watched Colin Powell try to get that done with regard to Sudan in 2002 and 2003, as I recall. And, you know, the protocol is the protocol, but genocide is a difficult thing to prove, and it's even more a difficult thing to get governments to act on. I think the bigger problem here is how do we negotiate a settlement? How do we stop this? How do we give a little bit of what Moscow wants, a little bit of what Kiev wants, and maybe sacrifice a lot of what NATO wants, Washington wants, on the altar of a deal? I think we have to do that.
But how do the arms companies, whose shares have been skyrocketing since the beginning of this conflict, as said in history media, because of course Russia said it began 8 years ago with the Russian, with the overthrow of the government in Kiev by US-backed forces. How does that benefit the arms companies if your prescription is followed and you have a peace settlement? It can't be in Switzerland, by the way. Switzerland no longer neutral. How does that benefit arms company money for which your American public is so generous to?
Well, you've got a point there. If you saw the piece in The Guardian yesterday or the day before yesterday, you know that one of the reasons The Guardian, and I think they're right, points out that the more draconian sanctions won't work on the oligarchs in Moscow is because Washington's oligarchs and Germany's oligarchs and France's oligarchs.
They're entrepreneurs.
They're together and they're working together in the banks and everything else. So I asked the same question about Moscow's military industrial complex. Will those influences keep this from being settled because they are making so much money off of it? And incidentally, Putin is making lots of money off increased gas prices. So those influences might indeed keep us from having a settlement to this conflict. I hope not, but I know how bad those influences are.
Even while the children of Ukraine are dying,
there are
these beneficiaries of this conflict that may that have such lobbying power can prolong a war.
Yes. Yes, they can prolong a war, they can get a war.
Now, if what you want doesn't happen, why do you think, say, Saudi Arabia wouldn't take Joe Biden's call? I mean, why would a power like that not take Joe Biden's call? Why would the UAE not support the United States?
If I were Osama bin Salman or the leadership in the Emirates, I would love the gas price increase. And I'll tell you why. Because they know, they see the handwriting on the wall. $8 billion, for example, was spent in the United States in the last 5 years on EVs, electrical vehicles. They see the handwriting on the wall. The market is moving away from fossil fuels. BlackRock, that owns, as you probably are aware, half the world, BlackRock has advised its investors, its shareholders, its companies to do the same thing. So they see they're going to have trillions and trillions of dollars of stranded assets. That is, assets they can't burn, assets they can't turn into cash. So they want the maximum price now for that gas and oil. So that's why they support this sort of thing. That's why they can't say anything about it, because they want it to continue to make that maximum price off that fuel.
And just very briefly on the New World Order, these components needed for this new electrical vehicle world and all the rest of it, the commodities, I mean, the London Metal Exchange closed down their nickel exchange this week because of the war in Ukraine. Yeah. Isn't that why they're so confident in Moscow and Beijing, actually, let alone in the global south, that this war is that turning point? The minerals and commodities, they're all going to go the other way. They're not going to go west anymore.
Who knows? I can tell you right now, most of my interlocutors in the global south are furiously angry with the global north, because we are doing things to fight climate change, finally. The market is moving that way, but we're leaving them out. We're completely excluding them, whether it's vaccines for COVID or whether it's movement towards their problems with clean water to drink or arable land, which is drying up now, and the water tables are shrinking. In West Africa, it's becoming an epidemic. They see us paying no attention to them. And they're right, because basically we aren't.
Colonel Larry Wilkerson, thank you.
Take care.
That's it for the final show in this studio, though if you're watching this on Saturday, it'll be replayed on Monday. And despite NATO Nation and EU censorship, we'll be back soon with a brand new look. But until then, we'll be showing you some of your favorite shows of the season so far. We again make an appeal to Ukrainian officials to come on the show to give their perspective on the war. You can keep in touch via all our social media if it's available in your country. And remember, you can continue to watch Going Underground episodes globally on TV outside NATO-aligned countries and always on Odyssey and at RT.com.